I'm Ryan Beasy, and this is the Westminster Standard Podcast. Happy New Year! The PCA General Assembly is only 6 months away, and already there are at least 8 overtures and 1 due overture on the General Assembly website waiting for consideration by this year's Assembly. As the Assembly approaches, we'll continue to look at some of the proposals before the court, and today I'm joined by the Reverend Alex Ford, who is the clerk of Northern California Presbytery and the author of Overture 2, which provide much-needed clarity on what is required for examinations when PCA ministers transfer to new presbyteries. Currently, there's a wide variety of practice regarding both the content and depth of exams given to PCA ministers when they move to a new presbytery. This overture has the potential to bring both greater unity and consistency to the Presbyterian Church in America, as we not only better understand what is required, but also better understand the views of PCA ministers. Welcome, Alex. Thanks for joining the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. So I learned that we were both ordained August 11, 2013.
Really?
At least.
All right.
Yes, yes. So we've been ordained more than 10 years together. Wonderful.
Yeah, that's hard to believe, by the way.
Yes. So tell me about your personal history. How did you come to the PCA, and where have you ministered during your time in the PCA?
Sure. Well, I grew up Unitarian, which is, you know, a little different. But then when I was in middle school, the Lord brought me to saving faith through a PCA congregation, through a youth group there in Columbia, South Carolina. And it just have been in the PCA ever since. This has been the only church home I've ever known. So, you know, I'm PCA from the early 90s.
Since you were born again.
Exactly. There you go. The whole time I've been a Christian, went to Covenant Seminary after college. Well, and after doing the RUF internship, since seminary, I've ministered in mostly rural areas, mostly small churches, central South Carolina, Raleigh, North Carolina, Charleston, West Virginia. And now I'm in Northern Utah, a little town called Brigham City, which nobody's ever heard of. That's all right.
Wow. Brigham City. So you're a Northern California Presbytery, but ministering in Utah, along with Ben Kappers. Is he's just in down the street, right, in Utah. All the churches are close together.
Yeah, he's very close. It's just 6 or 7 hours from me drive. It's right next door. He's actually in the same state, so this is great. You know, we've got Presbytery coming up in a couple of months, and I'll be flying to Hawaii for Presbytery. So, you know, it's a tough
I'm so
life.
Sorry sacrifice you have to do that.
Jesus. I know, right? It's really inconvenient.
Yes, but you know, you guys in on North Cali Presbytery, that is one of the challenges. You know, here in Tennessee Valley Presbytery, we complain if we've got to drive 2 hours to Knoxville, whereas you know your presbyteries may be, well, however long it would take
to get seven out of nine times to get to Presbytery.
Yeah,
there's at most one a year that I get to drive to, and this year I don't get any to drive to.
Wow. Well, thank you for your faithfulness and your commitment to our polity to do that. So you are the stated clerk in Northern California Presbytery. We have before us this Overture 2. How long have you been the stated clerk there?
Since October, officially. I was recording clerk for a couple of years before that, but just recently installed as stated clerk.
Excellent. So are you the author? What's the history of this this Overture
2? I am the author. So... The history of this is goes back to several years back. We had a gentleman transfer into the presbytery from another denomination. And in the minutes of that, as it made it up to RPR, we got dinged for they told us we had not written down, not recorded his examination on his theses, his written theses, his papers, theological and exegetical papers. And my initial reaction as parliamentarian, you know, I've generally put together the initial response for presbytery to edit. And my initial reaction was a very polite parliamentary version of get stuffed. I don't have to. And then because I'm paranoid, I went back and, you know, reexamined 13.6 and 21.4 and all the other places and thought, well, actually, maybe I'm wrong about this. And so we, you know, and I thought if I'm having a hard time parsing out exactly what's required and what's not in these situations. And I'm kind of become known as the BCO attracted Christian in the presbytery. if I'm having a hard time parsing that out, then it's unclear, and we need to do some work to get it a little bit more clear. So of course rewrote the response to RPR, which is neither here nor there. And then kind of started thinking about, well, all right, how would we need to rewrite this? Not even necessarily to change anything about our practice, just to make it clear what is actually expected of the presbyteries as they examine men transferring into the presbytery from either from a presbytery in the PCA or from outside the denomination. And so that was the goal. Now, in the end, I did add one thing, one specific that was not included in the old version at all. But actually, I pulled it from where this language comes from originally, from the 1869, I believe it is, draft from the PCUS. And that's the only change that I intended to put in was the requirement that there be a recording of rationale if you refuse to accept the man.
And that's
and also communication to his existing presbytery in the same circumstance, which seems pretty logical, seems like it'd be a useful thing to me, at least. But the rest of it, all of the rest of the so-called changes really were attempts to codify in clear, simple language what we're already doing.
Yes.
At least
or should be doing. Yeah.
Right. So I thought. I have discovered since it was published, maybe not every presbytery is doing it that way, but
Yeah. Well, let's just dive in. So here is the current BCO 13.6. It's one lengthy paragraph, and you know, if you're like me, I don't like lengthy paragraphs. I like lots of subparagraphs. And so, what you have done, what your presbytery has done—I guess it's not yours anymore—but what your presbytery has done is divide this into, I think, it's three subparagraphs.
Yeah, three subheadings.
So it looks like that's the main change, but you also made explicit the right of the presbytery to reject a minister. And then, as you said, inform his current presbytery as to the rationale, which, you know, I think is a helpful clarification. One, that the presbytery does have the right to reject a minister in good standing from another presbytery.
I mean, I think that's necessarily implicit in the current language. If you're doing an examination, well, what happens if you fail the examination? There's no point in examining if there's no result in failing an exam. That if nothing happens at that point, then why are we bothering with the exam?
Absolutely, yes. But someone might, well, what do you mean you can do that? It might come as a surprise.
And I will freely admit that most of the time, for the vast majority of candidates, especially transferring within the PCA, this is not an issue. It's not something that's going to come up most of the time. But it needs to be explicit that it is a possibility that you could theoretically at least screw up badly enough that a presbytery isn't choosing to accept you.
Right. I know my own presbytery, there was my presbytery is very middle of the road as far as, on the PCA spectrum. And they rejected a guy. I don't know if it was the presbytery or the committee just didn't recommend and then he withdrew. I don't know how you would get to the presbytery floor if the committee's not recommending you and there's no minority report on the committee. But even a middle of the road presbytery will turn a guy away. And then, in God's providence, the man that church called really served to be a unifying force.
And that's a great point because, all of this parliamentary procedural polity stuff is vital. It's important, but it's the means by which God shepherds the church. And so, As frustrating and as awkward as it can be to say to a man, look, I'm sorry, we're not going to pass you through. We're not going to transfer you. You're just not acceptable to this presbytery. That is part of God's work in his life and in the life of the churches.
Yes.
To bring the man that God wants, even if it's awkward and painful for those of us in the meantime.
Yes. To tell that church he's not coming. And, just because a man is a minister in good standing, I know that phrase gets thrown about by all sides in the PCA, but to be a minister in good standing doesn't necessarily mean that you are free to minister anywhere other than your own presbytery. And that's how we treat licentiates, that you're licensed in this presbytery, but when I was licensed in Grace Presbytery, I was reminded by one of my professors that in Mississippi Valley that licensure doesn't transfer. That if you come to be ordained here, you...
And even teaching elders, if they're going to be preaching regularly in a neighboring presbytery, are required to be licensed in that presbytery.
Yes, yes.
There is an assumption that there's going to be some formal relationship, some formal recognition by the presbytery in which he is ministering.
Yes, that's one of the things that I love about this proposed change, this overture, is that it does strengthen at least our awareness of presbytery's prerogatives, even if, as you say, these are already implicit in our book, but it makes us aware that the presbytery is the fundamental core of our system, and the presbytery has responsibility to care for the churches and to ensure that the men preaching in those pulpits are approved by a presbytery.
I'm on the Candidates Credentials Committee in our presbytery as well, have been in a couple other places, and I remind our guys somewhat regularly that there are two responsibilities for that committee. The first is to the candidates, right? To care for the candidates and shepherd them as much as we can. But the second, and the one that gets forgotten more often, is that we have a responsibility to the churches to protect them from guys who are going to be dangerous, who are going to be problematic, who are just, or not problematic, but just aren't prepared yet. We have a responsibility both directions, and it's easy to ignore the one in favor of the other.
Yes, yes. Well, let's look at this second paragraph. If an applicant comes from another denomination, the presbytery shall examine him as required in the trials listed in BCO 21:4. Just that first sentence I thought was quite helpful. We had a situation, at least one that I remember, where a guy was coming from the OPC into the PCA, having already been ordained to the PCA, then goes to the OPC, then comes back to the PCA. And, you know, we had to examine him and all the areas of a fresh ordinand. And there was some confusion about that, but I think the way you clean up this sentence makes that explicitly clear that yes, we don't know where what his areas are, so we need to examine him thoroughly.
Sure. Well, and the second sentence is helpful in that because, you know, for someone coming who'd been in the PCA and then the OPC and back to the PCA, we can certainly, the presbytery can choose to say, well, we're going to, you know, apply the extraordinary provisions here in BCO 21:4. We're going to apply that in this situation and maybe not require quite as much of him because we know him already. He's been, you know, in familiar places. But the default position is that you examine in all the things thoroughly as if he were coming as a new ordination.
Yes. Yes. All right. And then paragraph C, this is about differences. And there is some question about that. From a loose reading of the book as it currently stands, you know, does a guy have the status differences every time he comes into presbytery? Well, yes. In every case, presbyteries shall require each ordained minister entering the presbytery to state the specific instances in which he may differ with the confession and catechisms and any of their statements or propositions which differences the court judges. So, you know, have you had problem with that, you know, any with the differences that may be coming along?
So this is one of those areas that I was like, this is just what we do, and we just need to make it clear in the book. And again, since this was published, I've discovered that perhaps not every presbytery does this every time, that there's an assumption of, in some places, in some presbyteries by some men, there is an assumption that because you're already ordained in the PCA, your exceptions have been approved and therefore they're just accepted across the board. And I can see the grammatical argument from the current language, but I don't think that's the best understanding of the intention of those clauses in 21, of having a presbytery examine and approve stated differences, that is unique to each presbytery, and each presbytery has the right to re-examine whenever there's a transfer. And of course, if any man comes and says, you know, my views have changed, here's my new views, of course, there's a re-examination there as well.
Yes, yes. I remember one time, a guy, when I was in a different presbytery, he had been ordained in that presbytery or pastored in that presbytery for a number of years, gone and pastored somewhere else. and then come back to that same presbytery and the entirety of his floor exam. Now, I don't know what they did in committee because I wasn't there, but the entirety of his floor exam was, have your views changed since you were ordained in this presbytery?
Nice.
And he said, no. And that was it.
Nice.
Yes. Which, you know, I guess.
The benefit of being known personally to the presbytery, right?
Yes. And, you know, I don't know if that's the case now. I haven't been in that presbytery for years, but, you know, that did kind of, I did raise an eyebrow at that, but I guess that fulfills the language as it was written in the book then. Although I don't know if it would fulfill, the new language that you're, proposing, because, you know, you remove the word in paragraph A, touching. You know, what does touching sort of implies a light review of?
Yeah, that was one of the intentional changes that I made, because that language, that touching on language, is resident to the 1860s. And what it meant in 1860, 1869, whatever it was, what it meant then was, here are the subject matters on which you will be examined. It doesn't mean touching lightly on as opposed to digging thoroughly into. It was just, okay, yes. So this is what you're going to be examined in. Since the English language has changed and the word touching has a different connotation, conveys a different meaning now, it seemed wise to update that language to mean the same thing, but using the current nomenclature, current language.
Yeah, that's an important change. I wondered if that was behind it. So is your intent, and of course intent is sure. You know, the whereas clauses don't follow the what would be adopted by the assembly, that these would be a full exam as you would give an ordinand or licentiate.
No, because a new ordination or a licensure exam is an examination in knowledge and views.
Okay.
Whereas this exam is also examining him as to his views. So this would not be a knowledge exam as you would have when you're first coming for ordination. It would simply be, you know, tell me your view on paedo communion. Tell me your view on whatever, not, you know, tell me where does Paul say X, Y, Z.
Yes.
So there's that difference between a transfer exam, which is about your views, assuming that you have the knowledge because you've been examined and you've been ministering for a while, whatever. We're going to examine just your views, as opposed to original ordination or transfer from another denomination, where there is a focus on not just the views, but also, do you have the knowledge? Do you have the preparation that you will need to serve the church in this way?
Yeah, that's helpful. And I think this will be a good addition to a good amendment to our book, should it be adopted in a couple of years. Does that slowness frustrate you? You know, you've given birth to this thing, and you're going to have to, in a way, carry it for 18 months, possibly.
I mean, on some level, yeah, it would be nice if we could move more quickly. But this is the system that we have, and there's not really a better way to do it if we're going to make sure that everybody has the input that is appropriate to have. Mm-hmm. There are times when it would be nice to, okay, can we have a motion to, suspend the rules for a moment and just put this in?
Yeah.
But that probably won't pass. So.
No. Yeah. Yeah. But you could protest if it didn't pass.
Exactly. There you go.
So what was, did this pass your presbytery unanimously? What was the discussion like in presbytery as this?
It was voted on unanimously. The discussion was brief. I gave a presentation just, you know, here's what there is. Here's why I did these changes. Here's what I expect the changes to do, that kind of thing. And then opened it for questions. There really weren't any questions. A couple of, is this grammar the best kind of thing? And then we voted and it was unanimous. Partly that's because, new business comes last on the docket and we had kind of a heavy docket earlier in the day, but
the fight's gone out of them already.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. We had a judicial thing earlier in the day and
I'm sorry.
That was heavy. So this, yeah. People were ready to move on, and they'd had it for a couple of weeks. They'd had time to read it and look at it. And I'd had a couple of conversations offline with people answering questions before the meeting. So,
yeah. Yeah. Do you anticipate a lot of pushback, or do you think this will be passed in omnibus?
I mean, I didn't anticipate any pushback, but here we are.
Well, yeah. Have you gotten some pushback against
only
this?
A little bit, okay. As I said, there's been a couple of comments online about, some presbyteries that don't re-examine the exceptions. Some preferring the touching language because they believe that it should be a lighter exam. But mostly the responses that I've gotten have been almost universally in favor, coming from both the, you know, so-called right and the so-called left of the PCA. It's been pretty universally acceptable to the folks that I've talked to. So really, in all honesty, I expect it to pass pretty smoothly. You know, who knows what's going to happen once Overtures gets done with it. We'll see.
But, yes. And isn't that wonderful how Overtures works? You know, if someone's got some clunky grammar there, not saying that you do, but they often will take great pains to work that out and to improve language. But I think
it's great. I mean, it's the old line from, I think it was Churchill, you know, that democracy is the worst possible form of government except for all the others that have ever been tried.
Yes.
Well, the form of government that we have here in the PCA is often clunky and difficult to work with, but you know what? It produces a positive result far more often than not.
Yes.
And I appreciate the men who serve on Overtures and are so diligent to pursue the best possible good, the best possible version of these Overtures. So
yes. I was reflecting on that a few weeks ago with a panel, and how, you know, we fought and we argued and we were concerned for each other's souls over some hot button issues over the past few years, and yet.
Really? I don't know what you're talking about. I must have missed that.
You must have missed that, yeah. But the language that we have before our presbyteries now is just sailing through. And, you know, I think we got to a point where we could come together, we could agree, and just affirm the language. And a lot of, you know, I think, is it item two? That it's simply stating things that are already in our Constitution.
Right.
But putting them in the Book of Church Order, to which people can't take state a difference. There's no exceptions for the Book of Church Order. You have to follow it, like it or not.
Well, and it's an important distinction because the Westminster Standards are our statement of this is what we believe. This is what we believe Scripture teaches. Mm-hmm. BCO is more fundamentally, this is the behavior that we agree to abide by, the actions that we will do. That are applications, certainly, of our theological standards,
yes.
But they're different categories of book.
This is how we're going to operate.
Exactly.
And we have to operate by the same rules. I mean, Palmer Robertson was talking about, you know, something football. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a game. And there's something called a down in football. And some people get four downs and some people get five. And he doesn't think that's fair.
I am, in fact, familiar with football. It's the one with the round ball that you kick in the net, right?
I don't know.
One that's a violation of the commandment against murder. I got it. It's cool.
I don't know. I don't know. But something about a down. And if people have different numbers of down, that it's a problem. But he said we have to have the same rules. And, you know, I think to that point, I think this will help streamline and ensure that all the presbyteries are operating in the same way. So you've done great work here, and appreciate. How long did it take you to write this?
Well, once I put pen to paper, metaphorically speaking, it took me about 45 minutes.
Wow!
But I've been thinking about it for months.
Yes. Yeah. Probably ever you know, since you even serving as a recording clerk.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of those. I've been on candidates and credentials committees for a long time through multiple presbyteries, and it's one that this clause is one that we bump into regularly. Anytime somebody transfers, okay, well, 13.6, and you just see the difference between the specificity of 21.4 of 19, where we're talking about licensure, and then you get 13.6, and it's like this is just really much too compressed and not nearly clear enough. As far as what is required and where it's required, we're covering three or four different things in this one paragraph. It's not updated in a way that is matching the rest of the language in the BCO. It's been something I've been thinking about for a long time. But once I finally got that RPR response and started going, oh, wait, hang on, I've been misunderstanding this the whole time. Okay, I need to fix this. So that's kind of the origin of it. And as I say, once I sat down to actually edit it, 45 minutes or an hour and kind of cleared some of the decks of the language that needed to be adjusted. And really, I wasn't trying to make significant changes, which simplifies it a lot, right? I mean, it's just, okay, let me just write the same thing that we have, but more clearly.
Yes, and those three different sub paragraphs help with that, and going back to the old one of the old books, certainly did a lot of the heavy lifting, I'm sure. Now, how did you find the 1869 PCUS Book of Order?
Yeah, the PCA Historical Society, the historical records,
Wayne Sparkman's
the archive.
Outfit.
I forget what the official. Yeah, Wayne Sparkman's outfit. They've got the BCO project on that web, on PCAhistory.com or .org. And it has every edit ever made to the BCO, going back all the way back to the original version of the 1867, I think it is the original draft of the PCUS Book of Order. And so you've got, and it's all sorted by individual clauses, individual paragraphs. And so it's incredibly useful to look at that. And a lot of places, he's also got Ramsey's commentary and a couple other commentaries on it as well, specifically on each page. And so all of the research is done already. So, you know, kudos to Wayne Sparkman, because that's an incredible resource.
Yes. People don't realize the buried there in the basement of the Covenant Seminary Library, the Historical Center and the archives, I was wondering, but I didn't want to put words in your mouth. So I'm glad that to get another plug for the BCO project that they have there.
I'm on that page at least once a week. Looking things up and, you know, finding context and figuring out exactly how to answer questions from the presbytery. And so,
well, good.
Having that resource is an exceptional thing.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Wayne.
Yes. Thank you, Wayne. Anything else you'd like to tell us about this, this overture?
No, I think that pretty well covers it. As I say, I'm not trying to do anything new, other than the, recording the rationale and communicating that.
Yes.
Everything else was intended just to, let's make it clear what we're already doing.
Yes, it's already in there or clearly implied. That's what we like to see. Well, tell me, what excites you about the PCA right now?
What excites me about the PCA? I love the focus on, the paired focus on the gospel ministry with an intentional focus on theological grounding. I came up, as I mentioned, I came up through RUF and the focus there on a fixed theology and a flexible methodology has shaped my ministry everywhere I've been. It enables you to, you know, have ground to stand on, have a rock to stand on while you adjust to, you know, whatever the particular circumstances where you're currently ministering. Right now here in Utah, this place is different from anywhere I've ever been. And the ability to say, here we stand theologically, now let's react to, you know, respond to the circumstances that we have around us. I think the PCA does that better than almost anybody else. I mean, there's some other organizations obviously that do a good job with that sort of thing, sister denominations and such, but I've been encouraged to see how the PCA has held on to that through all of the ups and downs and conflicts that we've had.
Yeah, what are some of the changes? I mean, you've ministered in Carolina and West Virginia and now Utah. Those are very different parts of the country, all three of them. How have you adjusted your ministry? What's remained the same as you've ministered in those different places?
Well, my focus in wherever I'm ministering, my focus is very much on the means of grace, word, sacraments, and discipline. That doesn't change. Word, sacraments, and prayer, I should say. That doesn't change. That's the same everywhere. Now, what that looks like might end up being a little different. The illustrations that I use are different up the holler in West Virginia as opposed to, and I ministered 3 miles up a dead end road in West Virginia. So yeah,
wow,
cold camp. But the illustrations that I would use there are not the same as the illustrations that I used here or that I used in, you know, the suburbs of Raleigh. Those are significantly different places, but the basic principle is the same.
Yeah.
Here's God's word. Here's what it says. Here's who Christ is. Believe him. Now, you know, let's talk about how to understand that, how to explain it. Let's talk about how to apply that. But at heart, it's here's Christ.
Hmm.
And that doesn't change anywhere. You know, that's the same. I was actually overseas with MTW for a summer in Ukraine. Mumble years ago. And it was the same there too. I mean, obviously, you know, there's significant differences of culture, differences of language even. But it's the same basic principle. You preach the gospel. You show people Jesus.
It's the word
that really is what it boils down to.
Yes. Yes. That's so good to hear. I was talking a few weeks ago with Ike Reeder and Derek Bright about ministry in a prison where, you know, they've got some guy, you know, I think he killed five people. But now he's teaching on the hypostatic union. And it was the word that did that. You know, to hear again and again, we just need to be reminded constantly. It is the word, it is Christ who transformed lives. You know, we can come with an illustration and, you know, maybe it's funny here, but not funny there. And we find a different one that's going to resonate and it's going to hit home. But it is Christ who transforms. It is his word that gives life. Amen. What challenges do you see for the PCA in the next, you know, 50 years? This is, we just finished our 50th anniversary. So what challenges do you see ahead for us? And being out on toward the left coast, I guess you may be seeing things closer than we are.
Somewhat facetiously, I think the challenge is going to be to stop having GA always in the South, dadgummit. I mean, you know, the guys in the South complain about, as you say, complain about having to drive more than a couple hours. And I'm like, I fly everywhere. Leave me alone. Let's have it out here in Utah. Let's have it in California. Come visit me. But, you know, I understand the center of gravity and the center of population is in the South. I think, in all honesty, one of the challenges for the PCA is going to be to move beyond being a regional church, which I think we still are in a lot of ways, and actually transition to being more of a national and even international, given our Canadian brothers mm-hmm. and our Jamaican brothers and whatever else. You know, we need to find a way to make that shift to being more than just a regional body.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's going to look like. I have no idea how we're going to get there. And I think a lot of the conflicts that we've seen, certainly in the last 10 or 12 years, while they aren't about different regional identities, they are certainly exacerbated by different regional realities. The experience of somebody in the San Francisco Bay Area versus somebody in Tuscaloosa, those are very different places and very different ministry contexts to serve the Lord in. Well, the Lord doesn't change. Mm. The word doesn't change, but the context is very different. And we need to work to see where some of the differences that we complain and argue about are the result of cultural context rather than the result of theological difference with our understandings of Scripture, our understandings even of the Westminster Standards. That actually brings me to the area that I think we struggle the most in is, how do I put this, trust maybe? The assumption of goodwill of those in the denomination with whom we have some disagreements. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we get to where our default position is, I trust you in, I don't know, Central Georgia, East Tennessee, whatever it is, and I trust the guys in Southern California, and I trust the guys in Pacific Northwest, and I trust the guys in Northern New England, even though they put North right in their name. I mean, come on, how are you going to trust a guy like that? But I think that we struggle right now to trust those who are in different contexts who speak differently about the same truths. Mm. Generally, I've found once we sit down and talk face-to-face, most of those differences and disagreements kind of get smoothed over and everything's fine. We all kind of minister well together. But especially online, we struggle because we say things differently, meaning the same things or meaning very similar things, just in different contexts.
We only have 240 characters to say it too.
Well, yeah, you're not wrong about that. No. So I think that's probably the biggest struggle that we're facing. And, you know, obviously we're going to deal with particular issues, whether that's, you know, some of the things that we've dealt with. I think we're going to have to deal with some version of reckoning of how we respond to abuse situations. That's not going away. And, you know, I think that has been a present issue in the church, not necessarily in the PCA, but as much as just the church broadly, of which the PCA is a part. But it hasn't been acceptable to talk about.
Right.
I think perhaps it is a bigger issue than any of us have realized because it's just been under the carpet and behind closed doors. And as it's starting to come out, we're going to have to reckon with, okay, how do we respond well to this? Mm. Do we need to, and I think we do, restructure some of the book of discipline, the rules of discipline to be able to have the church respond well in that sort of situation. I don't know what that's going to look like. I am nobody's definition of a lawyer, but I do think our current rules of discipline are structured around theological disagreements more than they are around personal sin disagreement or personal sin issues in the lives of the leaders. And I think we're going to need to do some work to restructure that. I've been encouraged to see some of that work beginning. You know, as you say, we move slow. Nothing happens fast. You know, it took us 4 or 5 years to get through the most recent iteration of the conflict. And pretty much everybody was in agreement about what needed to be done there. We just, you know, iron out the details.
Yes.
Well, I think that the how we restructure to respond to abuse is going to have a lot broader range of what should be done, quote unquote. And so I think it's going to take longer. But I think it is essential that we work through what that looks like. Now, again, that's the surface level issue. And the deeper issue is how much do we trust each other and how much do we assume the best of the coordinate courts? But
yeah, that's where it gets hard. All right, we agree, but you know, when the rubber hits the road, we have a different way of getting there.
Right.
Even if the destination is the same. This abuse, and I wonder if we are at, you know, something in a denomination that's 0 to 50 years old versus one that's 50 to 100 years old, there's going to be some growing pains. I'm struck by, you know, I was visiting the offices of the PCA in Atlanta recently, and I was struck by the number of people whose surnames resemble those of former GA moderators. and you know, that's wonderful to see that generational legacy of a commitment to the church. But you know, that's something that can be it's much more possible in a denomination that's less than 50 years old.
Same way that physical numerical size, there are stages through which a church grows as it gets larger, and what a church of 50 can do, well. A church of 150 can't do well, but can do other things well. And then, you know, yet again, you've got another change when you break through about 200 to 250, you see another significant shift in the way the church ministers. Well, those are not, one is better than the other. They're just different.
Yes.
They're growth stages. And I think age is similar as we work through, we've worked through, you know, the first 10 or 15 years, we're establishing things. And then we've got, you know, the next stage that we're kind of coming to the end of, or have come to the end of, and now we're moving into the next stage. And I don't know what that's going to look like, but I think we've got some work to do.
Right, and also to treasure what we have now. Indeed. as a 50-year-old denomination, a largely regional church, although international, in foreign places like Utah, Texas, and California. but in the next phase of the PCA's life, we may we God willing will grow and expand to new areas. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this overture.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your efforts in getting it out there. I think this will serve the church well and help us to exercise and really manifest more unity.
I'm hoping.
All right. Thanks, Alex.
What is good.
Thanks for joining the conversation on the Westminster Standard, which is the podcast of Jude 3. For additional resources or to make a donation, visit our website, jude3pca.org. Thank you for your support of this program. Please like and subscribe to our social media. You can find us on Twitter at the WSPod and at J3PCA. Great things are happening in the PCA, so please come back next week to hear more encouraging news about God's faithfulness to revive and renew this branch of His kingdom. I'll be joined by Pastor Burke Parsons of St. Andrew's Chapel in Sanford, Florida. Burke Parsons will share some of his reasons for seeking to bring the once independent congregation into the Presbyterian Church in America. Next week's episode is one you won't want to miss. I'll talk to you then.